The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
A few years ago, I was at a meeting in Garrison, New York, at the Garrison Center.
Garrison Institute.
Thank you, Garrison Institute.
Or Omega.
Garrison Institute, yeah. Which is this, gorgeous old, I think it was a Christian monastery before it was the Garrison Institute landed there and does a lot of Buddhist programming. And they have this great hall and a balcony set above it, and this was a meeting for Buddhist teachers across the different lineages of Theravada and Vipassana stuff and Zen and Tibetan. And there was one day when we had a very intense day with where we did an activity where there was a lot of sort of self-disclosure in the group format, but a lot of self-disclosure and some very moving things unfolding, and a real sense of kind of being together in a deep way. It was very energetic, and that night there was a kind of, some of the teachers staged an impromptu dance party, and it was quite ecstatic in some ways. You could kind of taste the release from the day, and it's sort of wild to see a lot of Buddhist teachers dancing together, many of whom are quite famous, and there we were kind of dancing and a lot of joy. And I remember one of the participants, and it was made up of lay teachers and monastic teachers. As far as I know, most monastic codes, dancing's not allowed. So I remember being there sort of on the periphery, kind of dancing a bit and then looking up at the balcony, and Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is sort of maybe the foremost translator of Pali and just an incredibly inspiring life and human being. And in robes, a monk for many years. And I remember he kind of meandered out onto the balcony and was just looking down at us dancing. And it happened a couple times. He sort of wandered off and then came back and was looking down. And that image of looking up at him while this dancing is happening, and the kind of force of his presence and his curiosity about what was happening was very evocative for me. And still has presence in my mind. And I raise this memory because it echoes with what I wanted to talk about tonight, namely love, relationship, sexuality, in the context of Dharma practice. And the kind of curiosity of that moment looking up at Bhikkhu Bodhi somehow has some resonance with this sense of trying to live an embodied life. Most of us not choosing a monastic path, not choosing celibacy necessarily, and how to bring Dharma to bear on our relationships and our sexual lives, whatever the state of that life is. The psychologist Adam Phillips, and writer, says, at its best, committed relationship may be the wish to find someone to die with. At its worst, it is a cure for the terrors of aliveness. They are easily confused. So love is at, and love, I'm not using it in the sense of metta. Normally, that's what I'm saying. But love certainly includes metta, but I'm referring to the more traditional meaning of romantic love. And it's at the intersection of so many deep forces of the need to belong and the attachment, not so much in the Buddhist sense, but the kind of attachment that we have to dear and consistent, stable others. It's at the intersection of our relationship with our bodies and sexuality and of the evolutionary inheritance around procreation. And so amidst all of these intense forces, we can see that there are many Dharma themes that are in play, many ways in which we can see how traditional Dharma topics are relevant here. Courage, awareness, equanimity, not knowing, generosity, aggression. And in this realm, there's all this longing and clinging and tenderness and metta and desire, and it gets all tangled up. It's a mix of things. And some of what we're doing is distilling the wholesome from what complicates our relationships. So I'm interested in my Dharma practice, a little caution maybe about this talk, about I'm interested in the complexities of being human and the complications of loving well, and so this is not a romantic talk, I'm afraid. I realize I gave it recently. It's not a romantic talk, but that shouldn't be taken to mean that I don't have a lot of reverence for love, or that I'm disappointed in love, or it's quite beautiful and to be honored. And as practitioners, feels important to actually reflect and on what it's like, and the ways in which it's onward leading, and some of the ways in which our own suffering can spill out in the form of, in relationship. Now, I think a lot of the themes that I'm talking about are some of these experiences, the experiences of love and sexuality, are for many of us among the most private, the most beautiful, the most painful that we have as human beings. And so the encouragement always with Dharma talks, but maybe especially in reflecting on this topic, is to listen with a lot of tenderness, however this lands for you, and whatever's evoked, to listen to how you listen, or to be gentle with the echoes, responses, or reverberations in your mind. Now, maybe more than almost any realm, it seems that love and sexuality require so much awareness and flexibility, letting go. And there are some people who seem to be naturals. They just, I don't know, they know how to be in relationship and they make it look easy. It's been more humbling for me. And part of why it's humbling, I find, is that sometimes I even know what I need to do. I know how I need to let go, and I can't. And there's nothing more humbling than sort of knowing what's being asked of you, and just the momentum of everything makes it hard. Rilke says, "To love is good, love being difficult. For one human being to love another, that is perhaps the most difficult of all our tasks, the ultimate, the last test and proof, the work for which all other work is but preparation." Sometimes I feel like my Dharma practice is really dedicated to dying well. That I have some intuition of how much is asked of us to let go of this life and to let go of others. For the heart to remain open amidst the loss of people we love. And it feels in a certain way like much of my practice is dedicated to preparing my heart for that. But in another sense, my practice feels like it's dedicated not so much to dying well, but to loving well. I remember quite early in my practice hearing Jack Kornfield's question, like, we're at the end of our life, the question, how well did I love? This is going to carry great weight. Now, there are in this topic, and I'll be back next week, so we'll continue with this. In this this topic, there are so many cultural assumptions, and part of our practice is about becoming aware of assumptions that we make, things that look natural, look self-evident maybe, but are totally constructed. And so the assumptions of heterosexuality, of monogamy, of procreation, all these things, I don't make any of those assumptions. And it is curious that we default into conventional thinking often in the realm of love and sexuality. Again, this is Adam Phillips. Our survival at the very beginning of our lives involves us in something like monogamy. Our growing up involves us in something like infidelity. We challenge our parents, we betray them, let them down. So when we think about monogamy, we think about it as though we are still children and not adults as well. We don't know what adults think about monogamy. I appreciate that because some of our most rigid thinking, and we see this clearly culturally in the history of religion, history of this country, the thinking around sexuality is often quite rigid, we don't know how to think about it as adults in a way. And so the encouragement, of course, is that we open, and part of why I wanted to reflect on this is that we can actually do this together in some way. Now, not in all of Buddhism, but in a lot of Buddhism, the realm of sexuality is sort of gets lumped together with slightly dangerous pleasures. That's sort of the logical category. At least that's how it feels sometimes. And so it's like cotton candy, cocaine, sexuality. I know why they get grouped like that, because it is problematic, and sexual desire is painful. Sex may be wonderful. Sexual desire hurts. It hurts. And this is one of the lessons of renunciation and periods of celibacy, either in one's life or in the form of retreat, extended silent retreat practice. And so the monastics simplify the situation. Just it doesn't, of course, erase the realm of sexuality, but committing to celibacy simplifies things quite a bit. And it is not uncommon for people, when they are in the context of retreat, to be besieged by sexual desire. Some people get tired or angry or restless, and some people get really motivated by the whole realm of sexual desire. And how many people, I'm not going to ask personal questions, how many people have been on retreat, silent retreat? Okay. A friend of mine, a very sincere meditator, was on retreat, did a month-long retreat, and he was in his, I think it was maybe like early 20s. And it just happens sometimes that the way that desire or takes form is in the sexual way. And he said he felt like persecuted by sexual longing to such an extent that, and he didn't want to break the precept. Because you commit to celibacy, which includes not masturbating. And he didn't want to break that, and he didn't. But what he said is that he sort of was going to bed essentially praying that he would have an orgasm during his sleep so that he could experience the relief of that but not be breaking the precepts. Now, I don't know how we figure the karma of the prayer, but the point is, he said it was brutal, the whole adventure of the sexual longing. And I bring up what is a pretty dramatic example to highlight the point that is made that I think is important to acknowledge. Whatever we think about sexual pleasure and the emotional intimacy of that, the beauty and the ways in which it can be used as practice, sexual desire by its very definition implies the sense of incompletion, implies lack. And one of the senior monks in the Thai forest tradition, now Ajahn Amaro, who was here at IRC not long ago, described the word that he used for the celibacy and the commitments of monastics. The word he used for celibacy was peaceful. Peaceful. And we may say a lot of different things about our sexual lives, but I wouldn't call them peaceful, probably. Yeah. Part of why this realm can be complicated is that it often feels so, the echoes of the past are so strong, and our habits, we get a sense of how conditioned they are in this realm especially. Maybe in all realms, but in this realm it's like the repetition of it is quite striking. And it was Freud who said the finding of a love is really a re-finding of it. in the sense that it was the kind of maternal bond that's the prototype for love, and that to find something in our adult life is in a certain way a refinding. And I'm not a Freudian or don't want to reduce love to that, but I appreciate the way it highlights the sense of the past being very alive in this realm. It is a zone in which I feel, when I try to reflect on this love and relationship, sexuality, it's a zone where I feel quite opaque to myself. Right? Maybe you have some sense of the ways in which the mind, the ways in which Dharma practice is making the mind more and more transparent, and the ways in which there are still zones where it's like dense, opaque, hard to see, hard to know. And I have ways of understanding my relationship and ways of understanding the whole realm of love. I know the party line. I can say things that sound vaguely reflective about my life. But there's a sense that I don't really understand myself, or I don't understand myself deeply. Nietzsche said, there's always some madness in love, but there's always some reason in madness. Now, wrap up in a moment, but I want to say, and what we'll continue exploring, is that relationships do offer a kind of maybe unique way to understand ourselves. And there are certain habits that just don't arise on the cushion or don't arise readily. And that to actually see the ways in which we need to grow, we have to evoke the clinging that is often a part of loving. We have to actually see the shape of our clinging. And if we make relationship and love and sexuality a practice, it can help us get free in ways that are very important for ourselves and others. Let's just take a moment to sit together. So may our time together be a cause of more joy, more safety, more ease, may our practice spill out onto others. Thank you. Have a good week, and maybe I'll see you next week.